So I just didn't want to give you the dad joke.
Can you just unzip for a sec?
Yeah, sure.
And I'll just shove that in there.
Okay.
Just drop it
in. Oh, you're going to put that in there?
Yeah, yeah, if you don't mind.
Don't mind, yeah.
So all that can just go in there.
Oh, the wire, yeah.
But you touch yourself instead of me.
Mm-hmm.
And then just put these on here somewhere. There's two of them for... And then do it up as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Do you have anything in particular in mind, Nelly?
I think now we have this rhythm to let the person introduce, like Shania, and maybe Brian could tell us something about his aims, his expectations, and the collaborative maybe.
Mm-hmm.
That would be nice.
Okay.
Also about that, since it's so specific for you. And your involvement, it plays a really big part, and we could talk about, of course, all the different facets of what you're doing within the project as well, but also, I think, maybe in more general.
Take it.
I personally would be interested.
Well, two things I thought of, by the way, is when I walked into the to have a coffee with you the first morning, you told me this was like a dream project for you.
Totally,
that's a beautiful reflection. And then, and so I might just try to bring that up. And then the other thing was, you turned to me today and said something along the lines of like how people sometimes are overcritical of a concept before it even has the impact that it. I think that's what you were trying to say. I thought that was. It's really fascinating because we're all sort of turning on it now. This Anthropocene idea, and you know, trying to pick it apart in ways that maybe is a bit premature even. So I might try to bring that up. I don't know. See how it goes.
Sounds good.
Jimmy, you can switch a little bit so the sort of viewpoint is... Yep.
More like that?
I don't know.
That's
guess
good.
It's
that's good.
Yeah, you got light. Yeah, yeah, wow. It's really professional.
Of course.
You look angelic.
I don't feel it, so...
By the way, it's an honor. I'm a fan. So I guess the first thing would be to just introduce yourself however you see fit and say your name in there somewhere.
Well, I'm Brian Holmes. I'm an essayist and a map maker. I guess I've been involved with cultural politics for a long time in different ways. More on the side of grassroots protest and self-assertion a while ago, and now having returned to the United States and facing the immense problems in this country, I feel like I need to be more mainstream, to tell you the truth, because I'm not sure that these problems can be resolved by avant-garde means.
Well, okay. So we're sitting here in Lake Itasca, at the beginning of an adventure that you're taking part of. Are you going on the boat?
Yes, I'm going on a couple of legs of the boat journey. Quite happy about that. It's a chance to get a lot closer to this thing, the Mississippi River, this tangle of relationships that has got to include getting your feet wet at some point. Usually, you know, we think of the Mississippi as a bit too big to really deal with in a boat, you know. For that reason, I guess we're doing it canoes. Yeah, it's great. It harks back to things I used to love, mountaineering and whatnot. It's been a long time since I've been doing those things too. Yeah.
I mean, to frame it in terms of your self-asserted like return to America, you know, like that you're back here in the U.S. as you just said to deal with its immense problems. And the thing you said to me the other day, which is that it's a dream project for you. It's like it is really returning to America in a way that traverses it as well. And so maybe you could talk a bit about, you know, what that meant when you said it was a dream project. Like, is it something you've been thinking about for a while? Is it something that you've always wanted to do?
Well, I started working with maps and cartography. I mean, in a way, it's an old interest. You know, I always thought that the counter-globalization movement was cartography with your feet, you know. We would go collectively, massively to the spots where transnational power was dictating the future of the world. And we wanted to show what that form of government was and what was it doing, you know. coming as around the time I came back here was after, right exactly at the time of the failed Copenhagen COP 13, I believe it was, or was it 15? In any case, it was a big failure, and this brought home to me the gravity of the climate crisis. And yeah, also, I felt this was an area within which one could work here in the United States. I mean, one doesn't oneself deal with the immense problems of the United States. You just try to find some way to be part of a response, you know, that, and find a place wherein you can add your efforts to others. And I thought that, that this issue was such a place. And I also responded to a feeling in myself, feeling that I had when I was in Argentina, in their winter, our summer, exceptionally sunny winter for them. I was walking around the flooded territories of the Paraná River, and frankly, I was overcome by a feeling of desire for those environments. And I had also met someone who's an important collaborator, Alejandro Metin, who had a way of working with watersheds and rivers, river basins, all the different questions that go along with that, fundamentally questions of political ecology. And, you know, I had just finished a big project, my first big mapping project, which is called Petropolis. It's about oil, it's about oil refineries, it's about pipelines, it's about the tar sands, it's about the global petroleum system. It's devastating. It's a devastating panorama that you deal with when you attempt to really see how all that infrastructure works. It's you know, political economy. And I felt like I couldn't go on making purely critical works. And I will never give up doing critique, but I wanted to do something that integrated and brought me into contact with ecologies, with those places in which you can gain an understanding of that elusive word, ecology. And of course, I would do that as a political ecology. And so Alejandro and I made a project called Living Rivers, Rios Vivos, which is about the two great grain-producing watersheds of the Americas, namely the Mississippi River and the Paraná-Paraguay River. And that was the beginning of something way too big to simply leave behind after one project. You know, for Alejandro and I, we consider that an interbasin collaboration, you know. I don't think either of us intended to stop with one exhibition. For instance, the exhibition The Earth Will Not Abide, of which that was part. So when this project came up, it's something that I was already doing. And to do it with, you know, dozens and dozens of people, many of them already close collaborators in the Midwest, to do it here, not somewhere far away, but to do it here with that gaze that European institutions, and notably the HKW, can bring, was a dream project, definitely. And I've thrown myself into it for that reason.
Thank you. Very well. It makes me want to ask a question of what you think that other view is, but I'm not sure if that's on topic. Like what the other lens that the European institutions bring in, you think?
Oh, I think there's a capacity to integrate cultural and philosophical and now scientific questions in a way with a kind of freedom that we, freedom to let different disciplines and professions and non-professions coexist, and a confidence that public debate, valuable public debate, will spring from such from such projects that don't have a definite academic finality. You know, this is a big, big difference for a cultural producer in the United States, is that most serious art and a lot of the, you know, serious thinking goes on in universities. And universities, great places though they are, have difficulties with, you know, the sort of stovepiping of things. And also with the way that people's motivations are channeled by professional ambitions or ambitions and requirements are sort of inseparable. You always have to perform so much, and then you have to compete within an arena, which is the arena basically of your profession. In that sense, is it really that different from the corporate arena? You know, well, sometimes I have my doubts. I'm not a university professor. I'm a, you know, freier Schriftsteller at the origin. Now I'm acting as an artist, you know, so, which is kind of a funny thing to do in the United States, but hey, I could do nothing but give it a try, you know. So it's this year has been a really productive one for me. I've done 3 different sort of exhibitions in this year, and the 2 of them are really exploratory projects that are that involve a lot of other people. The other one was also fantastic and involves a lot of people, but it didn't quite have the sort of overflowing character that we encounter on this one or in the last thing that we did in Argentina with Alejandro.
I guess one thing to talk about is like where we are right now. There's a sense of there being a critique of the beginning of a river, or like a sense of like the ambiguity of that concept of what a watershed is, what the source of the river is. But nonetheless, we're here, you know, which is a kind of great, a great kind of contradictory thing anyway. Like, that's why the field station's here, that's why we're sitting in this place, that's why the launch is happening here, yet we all know that the possibility of the source, you know, as a single place.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, when we started this project with the group that I work with, Deep Time Chicago, we felt like, great, a project about the Mississippi. We're part of the Mississippi. Our city drains into the Mississippi, and for anthropogenic reasons, because the river was reversed in the year 1900. And that didn't seem to work, because the recognizability of the Mississippi River is a line that runs from Itasca to the Gulf of Mexico. I understand that it didn't work, because you have to communicate what you do, and you know, if you want to engage in a cultural politics that doesn't only produce an avant-garde or a subculture or an antagonistic movement, all those things being, I think, good things to do, very productive things to do, you know, I've been part of those things quite a bit, at this time, we're under a threat. To stick with that kind of limited, the idea that what you're going to do is not going to communicate to most people, I think, is not a good position to be in right now. I think it's time to take the risk of trying to reach out far beyond who you are. And in that sense, I think it's good to start with the clear line from Itasca to New Orleans and complicate it along the way in all the things that you do. I mean, I'm here for the bog, man, not for the river. I'm fascinated by wetlands, you know.
It's interesting that a question about the headwaters of the river made you think of that, because it is precisely that kind of place, right? Like what we saw today, where we went today was the headwaters. Maybe you could describe how you felt when you were there, but it was fascinating to me because it was a bunch of people showing up for something that we all kind of know doesn't exist. You know,
well, I'm not convinced it doesn't exist. I mean, this place is it's part of the geographical myth of America. It's a mythic place. That means that it's been worked over by 20th century mass culture, you know. It's really a 20th century place, and it was really made to reinforce a narrative with political consequences, the consequences of establishing the northern border of the United States and of, you know, creating the imaginary of, you know, the Mississippi is a big part of the imaginary of the United States. Of course, all that has been created, and in this case, it's been created on the basis of something. This is the highest lake which drains into the Mississippi. That means you can't find a higher body of water. That's real. There's something real about that. What's unreal is to consider that when you've stepped over the stones at the point where Lake Itasca begins to become a river, that you know the essence, the origin, and the be-all and end-all of the Mississippi. I don't think you do. I think that what's amazing and largely lost in the riverine environment is the way that the river flows out into the land and produces that sort of ecozone, you know, where there's no strict border between land and water. Up in this area, you really have a tremendous system of, call it what you want, wetlands, marshes, bogs, which are the headwaters of the Mississippi. That's where the initial water is coming from. But that process never stops. It keeps going, and every tributary has its headwaters. Every tributary has its marshlands and so on. These appear, you know, less damaged than others, but this too is a damaged land. It's one that was subject to tremendous logging, and right near here to all the mining of the Iron Range. So this is a characteristic place on the Mississippi, but it is the northernmost one. Yeah.
Great, thank you. So one of the things that I know fascinates you is these deep time as a concept, and the products that I know that came out of that through Jeremy and people were about sort of how, there's one called Trailways or something like that, where it was about the walking paths becoming highways, becoming telecommunications paths, or just where the older encounters of indigenous and settler communities then become cities, or, you know, and I'm curious about any feelings or thoughts you've had being up in this region, and some of the conversations that we were trying to have with Connie today about, you know, first encounters and stuff like that. Have you had any sense of that up here? Like, has there been a story that caught you about the way that, like, there's a deep time that you can trace here that seems to, maybe it's the 20th century story of the headwaters, but even before that? Like,
no, I think that what there's, you know, the same desire, the same longing that pulls myself and certainly many, many people towards the outdoors, towards natural environments in this moment when such places are so threatened, is, I think it's kind of complemented by a sensitivity that may be new for some people towards what has happened through the process of colonization in the Americas, specifically in the United States, which has been the dominant nation in the Western Hemisphere and in the world. What kind of violence has been exerted on people, and what kind of fortitude and courage and love it took for people to survive that violence. And so you become attentive to that. There are many stories that are much more interesting than the cooked up origin myth of the 20th century of the United States, because they contain, those stories contain the kind of resistance and also the kind of care for not only for each other, for one's people, but also for all those relations that make up an ecology. This is what we can learn from indigenous people, Native Americans, Indians. Again, let's pay attention to what people call themselves, and try to talk and try to learn. You know, I think that's also a very common feeling among people who sense their not just the urgency, but also the long, slow tragedy that is culminating now in our apprehension of climate change, and will again culminate later on in yet other things.
Well, I guess one of the questions would be like, why, or what expectations you might have, or what you think the encounter with the river might. You mentioned sort of what it will do to you earlier. Like, one way to answer that question would be like what you hope those who are going on the entire journey will kind of get from that, or maybe what you'll get out of the days that you'll be on the water, or if you can project your mind into like getting off the river, will it be a different Brian?
Oh, I don't have that sort of expectation. The difference that happens in oneself is it might every once in a while there's a moment like what I told you about. That's pretty rare. I want to experience this wonderful area here, and I also, like in everything, every relationship to, you know, what used to be called nature, you know, you experience a mixture of things precisely because it's no longer just nature. This is the political ecology of the present, you know. We're going to experience that here as elsewhere, you know, but differently here, of course. I mean, you could create an illusion about this. I'm not interested in that, but I am interested to feel it, you know, totally. I think that, yeah, it is a unique experience. It's a unique chance to do that. I haven't done these kind of outdoor activities much in the past couple of decades. I used to love it. I still do now, and here's a chance to do it with people who are definitely searching for something. You know, this is a quest, right? So you can dramatize that quest by making a river journey. It's a great way to do it. You know, dramatization is good, you know, but there's a life after the end of the play, you know what I mean? It goes on. I don't expect my journey into watersheds and rivers and wetlands to end with this project. But I certainly am glad for the chance to get in a canoe and also the chance to discuss with people who care.
Very nice.
Can I ask a question, Ryan? Could you elaborate more on your relationship to mapping and the concept of collaborative mapping? Sorry,
great.
You might have asked this, right? But this strikes me. That really interests me, and I guess since it's also this integral part of the project, it would be interesting to hear about that, what you understand as collaborative mapping and the concept of mapping.
Okay, I'm making, you know, maps with geographic information systems. It's a heritage of my days working with digital networks and learning free software also, and which, by the way, was kind of a pathway towards a lot of scientific knowledge, since so much scientific knowledge is computational and requires particular instruments that are you know, which you need to code and whose results you need to interpret using mathematics, if I could, you know, I mean, but at least trying to understand how scientific truths are produced. So I make maps with sophisticated digital technologies drawing on scientific information. I feel that's part of a critical and representational endeavor. It's also artistic, you know. I try to mix the representational, the critical, with elements that are in the order of the affective, so that there are different pathways, different modes of access to those maps. But I found that all of that rolled into a ball was still my thing. This would be, you know, what I think of as the watershed in your head, you know, in my head only. Now, how to share that? How to bring people into this world and give them some purchase there, you know, give them some grip on also these sophisticated forms of representation and critique that many people are feeling very alienated from. I understand the alienation, but I think that nonetheless we need to have that kind of knowledge which increases our sensibility, our sensitivity to what happens in the world and what happens at specific places, not just an abstraction, a formula of what is happening in the world, but an experience of it. So that experience does not end with a map, but leads through it to the place and then back again to the forms of knowledge that have created the technologies that are changing that place. You have kind of circular movement. How to bring other people into that? Well, this is an experiment. It's a kind of experiment that I also started doing in Argentina with Alejandro and a large group of people, and here it's an even larger group of people, and of course the experiment can fail. There's no certainty that this is a viable pathway, but it's definitely worth trying, I think. And so the idea here, the proposal, is this very sophisticated kind of map that again has some aesthetic pathways in it. If you like it, you may consider it, you know, that it looks beautiful, you know. If you hate it, you know, you have another relationship to it. But one way or the other, it does offer you a chance to contribute to it as a user of an application, you know, and piece of interactive software, really. The difference maybe with other forms of interactive software is there's a lot of material there, and that material, in a certain way, requires a little more engagement, because the idea is not simply to express oneself. The idea is to relate one's own expression to a place. That means each user of the map has to locate a place about which they want to talk, to express themselves, to project the images or the kinds of feelings that they have encountered in that place. And so there's a kind of level of engagement that's being sought there, a sort of particular level, not merely that now sort of enforced routine of the expression of myself in a context which is very abstract, because it's the context of it's a context. Okay, may I have a circle of friends usually, but one, that circle of friends is really maintained by an electronic network whose elements are all missing. They've all been made user-friendly. They've all, you know. Here there's something that resists a little bit. You're going to have to try a little harder to engage with this. Of course, one doesn't want to make it too hard. There's no, you know, the idea is to offer people this chance to engage not only with the map, but with the places. So there's a double kind of engagement there.
Great. Do you have the map?
The map is online, okay. So yes, I hear you. Yes, I have it in my pocket, and you have it in your pocket, but it requires a bit of attention. Those who would want to see it can look for mississippi.mapseed.org. Yeah, mississippi.mapseed.org. Then you can check it out.
Great.
Play around with it.
Maybe one more question about that Anthropocene concept idea, like somehow, one way to ask it might be what an Anthropocene river is, and maybe in that we could address a little bit like how you're feeling about that framing of these problems, the Anthropocene.
Well, an Anthropocene river is a problem, for sure. An Anthropocene river, I guess this one, the Mississippi, is a river that's been so heavily engineered and so subject to the needs of commerce that it becomes, from one viewpoint, a highway. So all across the world, large rivers are turned into highways. There's swift, deep channel to bring commodities to the sea. This you find everywhere. And those commodities are especially grain, but also coal, and then things that go downriver, you know? And then there's things that go upriver to supply those same production processes, which could be fertilizers, which could be chemicals, which could be fuels. A lot of things move on this riverine highway. But a river is also, so that's a you know, that's kind of a vertical movement, or a linear movement, let's call it that. It's a linear movement, but a river also has a horizontal spreading movement. A river is that which seasonally overflows its banks to turn land temporarily into water, creating all these sorts of habitat and really, you know, muddying the distinction between land and water, between what can be owned and what is impossible to own. River's kind of impossible to own. You can channel it, you can contain it, but it's always flowing, so you can't really own it. And so there's those two things, the highway for commerce and this seasonal pulse that overflows the banks. And that's, to me, is an Anthropocene river. So it's not, should never be just about the engineered aspects, just about the sort of toxic pollution, the disaster scenarios, and so on. It should also be about the vibrant life of a river, of all the creatures that inhabit it, the people as well as the animals, as well as the insects and the, you know, birds and everything, and the weather patterns. And when we take a river that's a continental scale river like the Mississippi, then we kind of go up to the scale of that science describes with abstract models of things that are like the hydro cycle and so on, but you never lose those places. You can never forget that this is not just a river, it's that river, the Mississippi River, or the Paraná River, the Columbia River, and so on. And so, yeah, for me, that would be an Anthropocene river. Fact is that all the great rivers always are centers. They're punctuated by big cities, by centers of civilization, and also by major industrial productive processes and commercial processes too. And so it's a kind of theater for those processes of global ecological change that ultimately disrupt the planetary system. And I think it's a kind of, because it's a, the Mississippi is such a part of the American myth, it's a very good pathway for people to get inside this double nature of a river in our times, and indeed of our times, tout court, of our existence in this present, you know, where you can no longer simply talk about political economy as you know, the Marxist in me used to do. But you have to talk about political ecology. Doesn't mean the economy goes out the window, or that you no longer care about the differences of class and race and of domination and oppression. It just means that you now understand that you, an organism, that we human beings as organisms are also part of a much larger organism, which is the Earth. And which has effects upon us. We don't own, it's not just that we have effects upon it, them, or whatever you want to call the Earth system, Gaia.
Great, thank you. Unless we wanted to talk a little specifically what happened in the days.
No. Yeah? I could listen to this for another week.
I know.
Yeah, but then it could get really long.
You gotta edit all this.
But you have such an amazing diction, actually. You really have a joy to listen to. You're on the radio. Have you ever done a radio show?
I never have.
You should. Really?
Yeah. People. Maybe we were talking about. We were talking, but now people have told me I should do podcasts. They never told me I should be on the radio. But thank you for.
Thank you for your pacing. It makes a person listen.
Oh, that's super. Yeah, thanks.
No problem. That's really a joy. Thank you.
And we could use this in various ways.